You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to NSLT, National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. We're continuing our series on energy, and this has to do with the expansion of AI. But now we're looking at the role of the African continent and China's continued influence there. Now, according to naval historians who've studied the history of military conflicts, China is starting to cut off supplies of critical minerals and will soon have a chokehold on mining. That means globally, a fifth indicator of impending conflict will be how China handles this. The removal of the United States soft power and the implementation of tariffs will have an impact that could assist China in these efforts. These same historians point out that World War II began in the Pacific after trade sanctions cut off Japan from vital resources that then included oil, steel, and rubber. Now, Sun Tzu, the author of Art of War, the book President Xi supposedly keeps on his nightstand, wrote of winning without fighting. China is clearly on its way. To choke off minerals, one step China would have to take would be to encircle the continent of Africa. Now, why? Well, maybe a lot of you haven't been there, but it's a magical, beautiful, teeming place. Africa is home to 30% of the world's mineral reserves, 8% of the world's natural gas, and 12% of the world's oil. Just to give you a perspective, Africa has bauxite, the main source of aluminum, gallium, and aluminum ore, which is an aluminum ore, chromite, which is used in stainless steel, cobalt, and I'll hover and pause here for a minute, with the world's largest amount that lithium ionic batteries use. That mineral is found mostly in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Industrial diamonds, those are the things used in abrasives, cutting tools, and other defense applications. Manganese, also used in batteries. Phosphate rock, I had to look this one up, but it's fertilizer critical to agriculture, as well as other things. Platinum group metals, catalyst in petroleum, medical uses, industrial, you get the picture here. Soda ash, vermiculite, zirconium. A recent study authored by Paul Nantulia from the Africa Center for Strategic Studies looks at China's port development in Africa. So, Paul, thank you very much for coming in tonight to talk about this study. We're very glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Elisa. Glad to be here.
So what is the scope of China's stakeholding in the ports of Africa as of our recording tonight?
China has a big stake in African port infrastructure, both as a builder, in other words, ports that have been designed and constructed by Chinese state-owned enterprises. It's always state-owned enterprises, at least for the moment. So that means that the Chinese government has a direct stake. And then in many cases, it is the upgrades of existing port infrastructures as well. In other cases, you have ownership or equity, right? So Chinese firms have equity in some of these port developments. And in other cases, you have Chinese firms that operate, right, or are part of a consortium that operates these ports. Now, the numbers, we've been tracking this for quite a bit of time at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. We've been watching the port development space for quite a bit of time. And 3 or 4 years ago, in terms of the publicly available information and publicly listed information, Chinese firms, state-owned enterprises, policy banks were involved in about 40 port developments on the African continent. Right now, that figure has jumped. And I have to include a caveat here that it may well be that in looking at these trends, some of that information was not publicly available, was not publicly held over the last 3 to 4 years, even more, that we've been looking at this space. So I just want to include that as a caveat. Today, Chinese firms are involved in at least 80 port developments around the African continent. That's pretty much double the numbers that we've been tracking over the last period of time. So it's quite huge. When we look at the port developments around the world that have a degree of involvement of Chinese firms and Chinese entities, the biggest concentration is on the African continent. So that's just to give a perspective. So it's quite significant. It's not something that any serious scholar of China in Africa, or indeed China in the world, this is not something that any serious analyst can ignore.
That's an enormous number of ports. On a map, is there a concentration or is it more or less encircling the continent? I'm only thinking about that because Nigeria has so much oil, Ghana has so much oil. Is there a concentration of this development in one place or another?
Elisa, very interestingly, we have observed from the trends that the current concentration of Chinese port developments in Africa is in West Africa. Now, this is really interesting for us because China has always been very careful about the West African region. China has tended to pursue a policy that avoids or refrains from antagonizing French interests. And the majority of former French colonies are in West Africa. But what we see over the last 5 to 7 years, that sense of caution has kind of disappeared. When you look at military developments, when you look at security developments, developments in terms of law enforcement, and indeed in the port development space, it's concentrated in West Africa. So some of the biggest port development, some of the most ambitious, you're talking about Lekki, for instance, in Nigeria. You're talking about Kribi in Cameroon. You're talking about Windhoek in Namibia. These are all on the Atlantic seaboard, the west coast of Africa. I think it's important for the listeners to recall that a few months ago, the Chinese Navy called a meeting in Shanghai to discuss security issues in the Gulf of Guinea. Right. And this is a region that China has been trying to extend its arc of naval activity. Right. China has had a continuous naval presence in African waters since 2008. That presence has mostly been confined to the Gulf of Aden, the waters off the Somali coast. But now China is beginning to look at the Gulf of Guinea, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is obviously economic, right? A lot of Chinese commerce traverses the Gulf of Guinea. So China is looking at this. The Atlantic seaboard, Chinese maritime as well as naval activities on the maritime seaboard in the west coast of Africa have concerned US analysts, US watchers of the maritime space, because that brings Chinese assets closer to the US homeland, right? So it's been interesting to see how the Chinese have increased their arc of engagement and basically concentrated these port developments on the west coast of Africa.
Can you talk a little bit about what might have brought China into this huge process, why that might have been necessary in Africa?
Look, it may not have been as a result of a deliberate strategy on the part of the Chinese. The Chinese are known for playing the long game, right? So they come out with these documents 30 years, 15 years. I mean, for the Chinese, a 5-year document is really not a strategy. In fact, because the word for strategy in Chinese is janwei. And when you look at the 5-year plans that China releases, these are 5-year plans that give the government targets. They're not called strategy documents. They're just simply called 5-year plans, FYPs. The word janwei is not used to describe this, right? Because in the Chinese setting, 5 years is not strategic. So they're looking 10 years, 15 years, 20, 30 years, right? When you look at it from that perspective, we started seeing Africa being mentioned in Chinese 5-year, because it's the 5-year plans that also have the guidance for maritime activity, right? These are folded into those 5-year plans. We began to see Africa in there in a serious way in the early 1990s. But I don't come from the school of thought that says that the Chinese necessarily said, this is what we want to see in Africa over the next 30 years. At that point in time, Chinese strategic thinking in Africa was not that developed. I think there were a number of drivers. One of these was Tiananmen, was a really important turning point for Chinese foreign policy. This was the point at which there was a break between China and the United States in particular, because there had been a rapprochement between our countries. The United States and China worked together very closely during the Cold War, in fact, even militarily. There was understanding, there was sharing of intelligence and that sort of thing. The United States played an important role in bringing China into the global economy, supporting the injection of foreign direct investment which was the engine for the kind of things that China was trying to do. We saw a break after Tiananmen because of the embargo, the embargoes that were imposed on China, the sanctions that were imposed on China. China then began to feel isolated. And we then saw a tilt back to the developing world, because there was a point during that rapprochement with the United States and Western countries, there was a policy drift away from the global South and away from the African continent. Indeed, African countries sent several delegations to China, requesting China to become re-engaged on the African continent. And China did not respond positively to that outreach. But Tiananmen, the Tiananmen incident, changed all that. So China then began looking for its old friends. And indeed, this is how post-Tiananmen China is described in the Chinese literature, in the Chinese press at that time. You find all these references to enemies are lowering at the gates. China must keep a low profile, bide its time, and engage in a process of self-strengthening. So China was feeling that pressure. Now, Tiananmen also coincided with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the collapse of all these communist regimes, there was a sense that China would be next. And so those student protests in Tiananmen, the Chinese leadership looked at that, and there was a sense that this could be an extension of what we saw in Eastern Europe, supported by the United States and the West, in the Chinese narrative, right? So from that vantage point, China began aggressively looking for markets in the developing world to counterbalance and to circumvent that isolation. So the establishment of the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation needs to be understood in the context of post-Tiananmen China, because the break that we saw continues to this day. In post-Tiananmen China, Jiang Zemin, who was president at the time, came up with this idea of go out. It was a policy that entailed massive state subsidies to state-owned enterprises to reach out to the developing world and to capture markets. So China's entry into Africa's port development space was an outgrowth of the go-out policy. So Africa suddenly became much more important and has continued to be important to China in that context. There was a financial incentive for these firms to reach out and to become involved in Africa's port development space. China also mobilized political support from African countries, because if you're a SOE and you're moving into the African continent, you don't really have that experience. You don't know who is who. As an executive of a state-owned enterprise, having the ability to open a door to see the president, to see the minister of finance, to see the director general of the port authority. Chinese firms have that ability because of the investments of that the Chinese government made in its go-out strategy. What we see today, those 78 port developments that I talk about in this report, the real starting point was 1998-1999. Then you have the establishment of the Forum for Africa-China Cooperation in 2000 to today. This is what I call the FOCAC, the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation era of China-Africa relations. So these port developments, those were the drivers. The idea that China needed to circumvent, needed to capture new markets, the idea that China needed to create dependencies and interdependencies that would allow China to change the way that global supply chains work. So this is the larger strategic picture and the strategic framing in which we need to understand these port developments in different parts of the African continent.
So that context is very helpful. And we have some listeners who are very young who may not realize that the events in Tiananmen Square, the tank, the student protests occurred not exactly coterminous with the fall of the Soviet Union, but close in time and at the fall of the Soviet Union. It also begs the question that placing China in isolation today may have other unanticipated consequences. And I recognize that may be a conversation for another day, but I'd like for you to talk about how this played out in one of Africa's busiest ports in Nigeria, which produces 1.3 million barrels of oil a day.
The China-Nigeria relationship is very interesting. While Nigeria played a very important role in supporting African liberation movements, the movements that were fighting for independence, because that was at the heart of Chinese foreign policy in the 1950s, the 1960s, and then towards the end of the Cold War. That is what China did. And Nigeria was a partner with China in that enterprise. But Nigeria also has other attributes, right? Nigeria has always traditionally worked with the United States, has always worked with the European Union, with Western countries. So when you look at the strategy documents of the United States, you look at all these powers. Nigeria has always been understood to be an anchor. But in the port development space, I mean, Nigeria has been extremely important because it allows China, it allows Chinese firms to capture that traffic. As the second largest economy and one of the most populous countries on the African continent and an economic power in Africa, you can imagine that, you know, the volume of trade that traverses Nigerian waters. So China wanted to capture that. Chinese firms have also been involved in developing inland ports and even river ports, right, in Nigeria, because it's extremely profitable. Lekki is going to be one of the largest deep water ports on the African continent. In fact, what the Chinese firms have been doing is helping those Nigerian ports like Lekki and others, Lagos and so on, to become increasingly automated so they can handle larger volumes. Then, of course, Nigeria is located in the Gulf of Guinea. It has one of the more capable navies. And indeed, the Nigerians have taken delivery of a number of Chinese-supplied vessels, naval vessels, as well as Coast Guard and so on, right? The Chinese have been very involved and have exercised quite a bit with the Chinese Navy. When you look at Chinese shippers like COSCO, right, which is one of the largest shippers in the world, COSCO has been working with the Nigerians to reduce the amount of time that it takes to take goods and services from Nigeria to Chinese ports and vice versa. So this is what COSCO has been doing. It's kind of like a replication of what COSCO did in Mombasa in Kenya, because COSCO reduced that travel time to 1 week. So the travel time between East African ports and Chinese ports, the travel time has been reduced by a week. So what China is doing in Nigeria essentially is not just developing that infrastructure, but also increasing the trade volumes. In working in this sector for the length of time that I have, so I try to talk to African port authorities, retired port authorities, diplomats, and so on. What I do in this work is I try to understand things from the African perspective. And time and again, African interlocutors have shared that China is helping African countries to conduct international trade because African countries rely on exports and they also import. And a lot of that infrastructure has been developed by Chinese firms. So African countries look at China as a country that has been a force multiplier in getting their goods to the international market. Those goods don't always end up in China. Some of them end up in Europe and so on. So Nigeria, when you talk to Nigerian officials, this is what they'll say. Nigerian officials will tell you that, look, the Chinese have been helping Nigeria to conduct international trade better. And that obviously benefits Nigeria. This is what Nigerian officials will say. The backbone of their trade has been essentially developed by Chinese state-owned firms. That is how it's seen from the official African perspective.
Historically, when this sort of international trade expansion has occurred, there's often a request to use militarily something that would have a capacity to receive China's massive military vessels. And it has an armada that's recently been described as unparalleled in the world. I wonder to myself, you know, whether African leaders have a little concern in the back of their minds about whether or not one day the favor will be called in for this investment. So I don't know if you're seeing care to comment on it.
Many of these port developments have dual use features. By dual use, I mean they can also be used for military purposes. So when the People's Liberation Army Navy shows up in a port to conduct military exercises with a country or a group of countries, right, as China has done, it's the ports that provide that infrastructure. That tells us that these ports, one, can handle Chinese military logistics. Two, they can handle Chinese military traffic. Three, they can protect, because when you're conducting an exercise, force protection is also important, right? You've got to protect the forces that are conducting that exercise. And in military terms, force protection sometimes is even more important. You've got to be able to protect the equipment that you bring. You've got to be able to protect the troops that you bring, right? So when China conducts an exercise with Tanzania, what we read is, you know, the Chinese have conducted this exercise. They've done A, B, and C. Rarely do we ever talk about what is the logistical footprint of this exercise. Many of these ports are dual use, and I identify these in the report. The second is some of these ports can be suitable to be turned into military bases. Now, if you look at Djibouti, the Chinese naval base in Djibouti, which was established in 2017, it started off as a commercial port development, one of the most advanced ports on the African continent and so on. And initially, concerns were actually raised in the Kenyan press in particular. In some way, some of that information leaked. And the Chinese government was very quick to deny that it was going to convert this facility into a military base. But that is what happened. And the Chinese are creatures of habit, and they're also creatures of precedent, right, culturally. So the Djibouti model is extremely important for the PLA, for the People's Liberation Army. It has persuaded the Chinese military that this is a model that can be replicated, because a Chinese military facility is not necessarily going to be, at least for now. I try to examine Chinese military writings, Chinese military journals like PLA Daily, like the Winged Missiles Journal and stuff like that. It's laborious work, but it has to be done to try and get an understanding about what is the Chinese military establishment telling itself. When you mine through Chinese military writings, you find lots of discussions about basing. And those discussions revolve around Djibouti, replicating Djibouti, not just in Africa, but in other places. And Djibouti can be replicated in many ways. The Chinese, for instance, may be able to negotiate special military access with, say, Kenya or Tanzania, special military access whereby it's not really a Chinese base, but it's a Tanzanian maritime or naval facility, right, that gives access to the Chinese military. It could be something like that, right? China also builds naval bases for African militaries. It also builds military facilities. So there's a whole permutation of models that civil and military dual use applications that China can use. This has created some concern. You know, there's more discussion in the African media about Chinese basing. There's more discussion within African civil society, African professionals. You know, now you have a proliferation of centers for China studies. You have coalitions of African scholars, right, that are following China. Discussions of the Chinese military on the African continent and the consequences of, for instance, basing are now being discussed openly. So there are concerns that have been voiced about the potential conversion of these what appear to be purely economic and commercial ventures into military facilities. The third thing that I would say is some of these ports, so we found seven of these ports that can actually berth major Chinese combatants, like frigates, destroyers, and things of that nature, right? And these ports are listed in the study. Now, it may well be that they were not necessarily designed with that in mind, but nevertheless, when one looks at the specifications and when one looks at the size, the tonnage, and the displacement volume of Chinese assets, they can comfortably berth major Chinese combatants. So sometime in future, in a scenario where the Chinese military will need to use some of these facilities or need to berth in some of these facilities, you already have an infrastructure. So what we look at when we follow African port developments, maritime developments, we look at things like that. We look at the exercises, because exercises are a very important indicator. The PLA Navy has dropped anchor in at least 30 of those ports, right? So we look at that. You look at things like imports, military imports. Some of these countries get 90% of their military hardware from China. Where do they get it? It doesn't come from the air. It comes by sea. So that means that they must surely be able to have a capacity to receive serious Chinese hardware like tanks, armored personnel carriers, and so on, right? Countries like Tanzania have that capability. Then you also have situations where you have special military-controlled ports that are run by Chinese firms. And Egypt is one of those, right? The Egyptian Air Force has got a special port that is run by a Chinese state-owned firm. Might that become a model that other African countries use? We don't know. People don't discuss this, right? So that allows the People's Liberation Army to do a lot of things because people don't really pay attention to what the PLA is doing on the African continent and how the PLA is using or might use these port infrastructure in future.
You've talked a lot about the go-out strategy as well as the bilateral exercises. And you've talked about 78 total ports. With respect to sort of the handling and logistics involved in berthing a vessel, like the husbanding of ships, I imagine China's developed relationships with companies on the continent that can provide these services. Is that right?
Yes, clearly. China has developed these relationships, right? I mean, China is supplying almost every African country with hardware, right? This hardware shows up in ports, right? So there must be some kind of investment that China is making in ensuring that these ports are able to handle military logistics. This just goes without saying.
Just flows. Right.
Yes.
And the other thing is, I think it's difficult maybe for people to understand the size of the vessels that China is now using in shipping. And I think they are shocking when you see them, including things like the roll-on, roll-off vessels that they use for transporting vehicles. It is something out of science fiction to see one of those in a port. But you've talked a little bit about the Chinese naval connections in Egypt. What about in Ethiopia, since they are both on the Nile, and the Nile is obviously a critical source of water and other things for Africa? Have you seen whether or not China has, because you mentioned internally on rivers, mini ports here and there, have you seen China move into this important river that flows between, you know, Egypt and Ethiopia?
We haven't seen that. So the African river ports that have been developed with Chinese investment, mainly we see this in West Africa, you know, countries like Gabon, Nigeria and others, you know, this is where we see it, you know, Tema in, you know, in Ghana and so on. We haven't seen it in the Nile. You know, the Nile waters are very hot, unresolved conflicts dating back to the colonial period, the way in which the Nile waters are supposed to flow. Countries are basically saying we cannot continue to adhere to these colonial agreements because these colonial agreements that govern the flow of the Nile waters were concluded, one, before these countries became independent. Two, the population has more than tripled, you know, from the time these agreements were signed. And there's a big demand, water resources, electricity, and so on. This is a sticky issue for the upstream countries and the downstream countries, right? I mean, there have been instances where countries have almost gone to war over the Nile waters. So China has stayed out of the Nile and tended to invest in good relations with Uganda, with Sudan, with South Sudan, with Ethiopia, and with Egypt in particular, because this is really where the contention is. And China has really stayed out of this, right? So we haven't seen any significant Chinese investment in any of this. There has been some Chinese involvement in the construction of the Grand Dam, the Renaissance Dam, this Ethiopian dam. There has been some involvement in that. But again, it's been very careful. The Chinese government has been very, very, very attentive to these problems. Secondly, China also has a what it calls a Horn of Africa Peace and Development Initiative, which kicked off in 2021. And that initiative brings all these countries of the Nile, well, the Horn of Africa countries, together regularly to basically discuss security issues between them. And China kind of touts this as an example of China contributing to peace and stability and so on. So China has, from a narrative perspective, any serious engagement in and around the Nile waters would undermine that narrative. Because China, narratives are also important. You know, narratives, communication, propaganda, these are very important to China, right? So any of that would actually undermine this Horn of Africa. It's met like three times. And China, you know, they're always talking about this thing. So we have not seen that. But the Chinese engagement in Ethiopia is strong. It's long-lasting. Over 500 Chinese companies are operating there. They even have a special program for, it's like a finishing program for Ethiopian senior officers when it's the, sort of like the last step in their professional military education experience, which they do in China at the Chinese National Defense University, right? And that's, and then from there, they become generals. And then they also have similar programs with Egypt. The Nile has always been essential to life in Egypt, right? Egypt is nothing without the Nile. So what China has done is basically, it's a hedging game. They have just done some major aerial exercises of the Air Force between the Chinese Air Force and the Egyptian Air Force. Actually, this is the first time that China has conducted an exercise with an African country that has purely been air-oriented. And I'm sure the Ethiopians were watching that very, very carefully because the Ethiopians also train with the Chinese military. So what China has done in that situation is basically pursue a policy of ensuring that all the countries of the Nile are happy with China and do not think that China is undermining them in any way.
Let's go back and talk about China's ranking of partnership prioritization. Can you talk about what that is and what you have observed China doing in terms of spending its money and its long-term goals in Africa?
So China has a system of prioritization where it ranks countries based on their importance to Chinese interest. They've got five levels of this, right? They call it strategic partnership. And then strategic comprehensive, then strategic cooperative. It's different levels, right? So around 28, maybe around 30, maybe 31, 32 African countries are in one of those five rankings in Chinese diplomacy. And the lowest level is strategic partnership relations. Strategic partnership relations just basically means that the two sides agree that they have a strategic relationship, and it's a relationship primarily economic and commercial. But strategic partnership relations is basically a statement of intent to move up the ladder of interest. Indeed, we have seen countries that have started at the strategic partnership level, which are now strategic, comprehensive, cooperative partnership. That's the highest. So Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, Nigeria, many of these countries started at the strategic partnership level, and then they just went up. So for instance, Kenya is basically at that level. You can compare it with Pakistan. You can compare it with Russia, for instance, right? The way these countries are ranked. With respect to Kenya, you have a very strong economic relationship. Essentially, Kenya's infrastructure building has been bankrolled by China and built by Chinese firms. Kenya infrastructure is extremely important to Kenya's strategic objectives. And the Chinese have played an important role, not just in the current phase, but going all the way back to the Mwai Kibaki administration, this is two presidencies ago. Then they have a political relationship. The Communist Party of China, which runs these party-to-party exchanges, where they talk about ideology, they talk about formulating common positions in international institutions and so on. Kenya has built a close political relationship with China, right? And so you always have this conveyor belt of Chinese Communist Party cadres going to Nairobi for exchanges. And then you have political cadres from the ruling party of Kenya going to China. In fact, the current ruling party, the United Democratic Alliance, is trying to work with the Chinese Communist Party to build a political school in Kenya, in Nairobi, to train.
A political school.
Yes, a political school to train and strengthen their party in terms of management, in terms of revenue, in terms of strategy, in terms of tactics and so on, right? These are things that China does. Then they have a strong relationship on the diplomatic front. So Kenya will not frustrate Chinese positions in international institutions. You know, One China, for instance.
One China policy, right. Yeah.
So Kenya will not entertain, you know, sort of relations with Taiwan, for instance, right? Kenya will not frustrate Chinese positions on Xinjiang, on the Hong Kong national security law and things of that nature, right? China will always be assured that when these things come up for mention in international institutions, Kenya will not frustrate the People's Republic of China. Then they have a strong defense relationship. Then they have a law enforcement cooperation and so on. So strategic, comprehensive, cooperative partnership means that China and the country concerned basically have an all-round relationship. Not all countries have that.
This begs the question, these diplomatic relationships, this building of infrastructure, you see it in Africa, you can see Chinese crews literally building highways on the continent. Do African leaders, publicly or privately that you know, ever express alarm over the implications of China's expansion to their own sovereignty and security? Do they have any concerns about getting ensnared in what is, you know, presently some sort of a developing Cold War, hopefully will be eliminated in the future, but a Cold War that appears to be growing to many nations between the United States and China? And by the way, I'm not saying this because I think we're fully in it, but for those of you that read the international press, this is how it's being described. What are African leaders thinking or saying that you're hearing?
Well, African leaders are basically watching and figuring out how to respond. Kenya is a very good example. So recently, President William Ruto had a state visit to China, and China pulled all the stops to make a huge deal out of that, to get as maximum diplomatic clout as it could. But not too long ago, President Ruto was in the United States. And in the United States, with equal vigor, his visit, I mean, it was a visit of a kind. It was the first time in many, 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 many years that the United States had hosted an African leader at that level. So what the Kenyans are trying to do, they're trying to keep their international options open. And when you listen to African strategic debates, like influential African think tanks on this particular issue, yes, there is a concern of being pulled one way or the other. And this creates memories of the Cold War, when African countries were either pro-West or pro-East. If they were pro-West, they antagonized the East. If they were pro-East, they antagonized the West. Again, Kenya is a good example. Kenya was pro-West and antagonized the East. Tanzania was pro-East and antagonized the West. What Kenya is doing basically encapsulates African strategic thinking. It is in the diplomatic DNA of African countries to keep an all options on the table strategy. One of my professors calls it diversifying dependency. By diversifying dependency, you are actually reducing your dependence. I would call it a diversifying interdependence. So they're dealing with the Gulf countries. They're dealing with China, but then they're also dealing with Japan. They're dealing with Korea. They're dealing with Singapore. They're dealing with Indonesia. They're dealing with Brazil. They're dealing with the United States. They're dealing with the United Kingdom. They're dealing with everybody. This is what African countries have traditionally done from the 1960s. And I suspect that African countries are going to continue to want to do that. Some African strategic thinkers call it non-alignment, whereby you're not aligned to anybody. If you're not aligned to everybody, it means you're aligned to everybody.
it sounds like some sort of strategy that may have been developed carefully and thoughtfully by intelligent people surviving colonial rule.
Yes.
They figured out how to preserve themselves in great adversity over a long period of time.
I think it's a strategy of strategic self-preservation. Just because countries are developing strong relations with China does not mean that they will not be interested in developing strong relations with the United States. I think this is just basically part of Africa's diplomatic practice.
Well, let's see. The DRC, which is where I've just learned Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos are interested in establishing cobalt mining, as it's been reported now in international financial news. So the DRC would have only one little teeny strip on the sea, right? I don't think it certainly is almost a landlocked country. So all of these minerals that the president says it's going to seek from various countries, obviously he's negotiating some sort of arrangement with Ukraine. The minerals in DRC of great interest, particularly the cobalt, are of great interest. So at some point, these minerals are going to have to make their way to the sea. And they're going to have access from infrastructure, which may or may not have been built by China. It's going to be interesting to see how this sort of confluence of changes in the world, the development of AI, which requires more energy, more batteries, the encircling of the ports of China, how these things come together, because you've described major world events coming together in the past, and those had a significant change in how China saw Africa. And I believe we're at another pivot point in history. I found your report especially interesting. I hope you're going to write another one. I hope you have something cooking right now, and we'll look forward to reading it. I really thank you for the thought, the intelligence that you brought to this.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. You've been most kind. We've been trying to have this engagement for quite a while. I'm very, very happy that we've been able to have it. And yes, I do have a lot of things cooking, a lot of things on the China-Africa front that will be coming out in the next several months. I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for bringing this work, for bringing these ideas to a larger audience. I always welcome feedback. I even welcome criticism. It makes one a better analyst and makes one a better public intellectual. Thank you. Thank you. We would not be able to do any of this work without people like you.
My pleasure. I'm really glad to talk to you tonight. My guest has been Paul Nantulia of the African Center for Strategic Studies. He is the author of Mapping China's Strategic Port Developments in Africa. We'll hyperlink that in the notes to this cast. And for more on the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, you can find them in africacenter.org. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to give us a rating on your listening app of choice and like and share this podcast. We're committed to bringing you cost-free, intelligent content that will enrich you and make you definitely the smartest person at the party or in any conversation with your friends, but it will also develop you professionally to consider the world in a wider context. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. And when you do discuss it with other people, do so in a thoughtful way. Hear other people's opinions and arguments. It will definitely improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country more diverse in thought than any other. Our producer, writer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. And I want a special thanks tonight to Antasia Hawkins, who has assisted us on this late evening recording. And we'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.